Support for Alaska Public Media On Demand comes from Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, marking nearly 50 years of commitment to operating the Trans-Alaska Pipeline System. More at alyeskapipeline.com.
Hello and welcome to Line One, Your Health Connection. I'm your host, Dr. Monique Andrews, a licensed therapist and professor of psychology at Alaska Pacific University. When we talk about bipolar disorder, we're talking about a condition that brings extreme shifts in mood, from the highest highs to the lowest lows. It can feel like an emotional roller coaster, not just for the person on it, but for the people they're close to. Today, we'll learn about bipolar disorder and talk about a common challenge when people with bipolar disorder also have a substance use disorder. They often feed into each other. Someone might use substances to quiet a manic episode or to lift themselves out of a deep depression. It's a complex cycle, but as we'll discuss today, it's one that can be interrupted. According to research, about a third to half of people with bipolar disorder will struggle with a substance use disorder at some points in their lives. Today, we're talking about the reality of living with bipolar disorder, the frequent overlap of addiction, and the hope of transformation. Joining me today are two wonderful guests, Dr. Erica Horwitz, a licensed psychologist joining us all the way from Canada. She's the co-author of the memoir, Improbable and Extraordinary, which she wrote with her brother, Saul, about his incredible journey through addiction and struggling with bipolar disorder. Also here is Sam Garcia. He is the owner and operator of Peer of Heart Consulting and the director of peer support and community outreach at eMend Alaska. In addition, Sam is a member of the Alaska Advisory Board on Alcoholism and Drug Abuse. Erica, Sam, welcome to Line One. It's so good to have you both here. Before we dive into the heart of Saul's story and experiences of people with bipolar disorder, I'd love to get to know both of your professional backgrounds and the specific lenses you bring to this conversation. So how about we start with Erica? Can you introduce yourself and tell us a little bit about your background?
Well, hi, Sam and Monique. It's very nice to be here. I'm very honored and excited. So yeah, my name is Erica Horwitz. I am a licensed psychologist, and I have been working in as a psychotherapist for over 30 years. I'm also have a lot of experience working with younger folks, as I was director of counseling services at Simon Fraser University. I'm currently the president of the British Columbia Psychological Association, doing a lot of advocacy. I like working at the different layers in our field, you know, directly working with people as a psychotherapist, but also trying to make a difference through advocacy and so on. And, and my passion is helping. So, writing this book was a passion project. Having seen my brother go from the depths of darkness from his bipolar disorder to transforming in a way that I've never witnessed in my world as a psychologist. So I just felt that telling his story was extremely important because it can be inspiring to others.
Yes, thank you so much, Erica. Now turning to Sam, would you introduce yourself and tell us about your work?
Yeah, good morning. My name is Sam Garcia. I'm a certified chemical dependency counselor and was one of the first certified peer support specialists for the state. The qualifications to be a peer support is somebody that's in long-term recovery from substance use disorder. So for myself, I haven't had a drink or drug since April 8th of 2016.
Amen.
Thank you. So if everything goes well in another week here, I'll hit my 10 years. And I currently operate a consulting business called Peer of Heart to help, expand peer services, help organizations that deliver direct services to anybody struggling with substance use, mental health, or all the different traumas you can accrue. And then on the other side of things, I help operate, well, we'll help operate a new treatment program we're building out called Amend Alaska. And it'll be the full continuum of services from detox all the way through outpatient. My goal is to get a mobile crisis team going. And then they already operate several mental health facilities in the lower 48. So that will probably be on the horizon as well.
All right. Thank you for being here, Sam, and congratulations on 10 years. Let's start with some discussion about the word bipolar. We hear the term used a lot in pop culture, but clinically, the reality is a little bit more nuanced. So, Erica, many people know bipolar disorder involves mood swings, but could you explain the difference between a high or mania and a low or depression?
All right. So bipolar, the word bipolar is that you know, people with bipolar disorder experience the two poles, right? The two extremes of mood. One is low mood depression. The other one is, you know, higher mood mania. In depression, of course, people feel sad a lot of the time. They feel no energy. They have a lot of negative self-talk. Depending on how low they feel hopeless. So it's a state that really hijacks a person's energy and, you know, wanting to be engaged with life. Mania, on the other hand, is the high mood. And what's interesting about mania is that it presents differently for different people, or even for the same person, mania can present differently. But people can feel a big high with lots of energy and wanting to get lots done, or having a lot of dreams or a lot of ideas. There's people who experience mania sometimes as extremely irritability. They feel very agitated. So they're, like we say in Mexico, where I'm from, accelerated, right? They're very, but not necessarily in a good mood. But it really is just very high energy with mania, and then very low mood energy with depression.
Okay, so mania is more than just being happy. It sounds like it's a period of abnormal high energy, racing thoughts, and often decreased need for sleep. And then the opposite, depressive episode is marked by intense sadness, hopelessness, and maybe sounds like even a total loss of interest in life. And this is a question for both of you all. We can start with Sam. What does that look like? Erica did a great description, but what can it look like with boots on the ground with individuals experiencing a depressive episode or a manic episode? And what can that look like for their loved ones, the people who love them and experience this with them?
Yeah, so from a peer support standpoint, it can appear like unpredictable as far as the ups and downs, right? You might not necessarily know what you're going to be walking into on a certain day with the person, you know? And like Erica said, it can be like extreme up and a lot of energy and motivation, and then it can go to this other side, right? So it can looks very impulsive, just because it's kind of going from thing to thing, some paranoia. My stepfather was diagnosed way later on. He passed away a few years ago, but kind of made some sense with some things. Yeah, I think it was that unpredictability. And from a family or loved one's standpoint, especially if you're like, if you don't have a good basis of like mental health and what that looks like, I mean, it can be very scary. 'Cause all the answers and solutions you're looking for on why your loved one is acting like this is just, it's not in your wheelhouse, right? So you're searching for answers and solutions that you just don't have. And that for most people is scary. So it's, very exhausting. You know, I have family members that call me all the time searching for help with their loved one. And I mean, the reality for like a lot of mental health in Alaska is we're very, very limited, especially if you need anything over outpatient.
Okay, thank you. And Erica, you and Sam did a great job kind of explaining that, but often we hear the terms bipolar 1 and bipolar 2. How do these differ, and why is it important to get that specific diagnosis?
Just to add to what Sam was saying, I agree that bipolar disorder, before it is identified, can be very disorienting for the person or their family, and it is sometimes people think, oh, the person is just irresponsible, or the person is just lazy, or they don't have an interest, or so to me the one of the problems is when it's not diagnosed. And so for bipolar 1 and bipolar 2, which are the two diagnoses, the main difference is mania. Both in bipolar 1 and bipolar 2, the depression can be quite severe or moderate. But in bipolar 1, the mania can get quite severe and may involve psychosis, which is, experiencing almost like a different reality, right? So in psychosis, the person may start feeling a lot of paranoia, fear of something that's extremely irrational happening, or they may feel they can fly. I had a patient once who just thought she could jump out of a third floor trying to chase her boyfriend who was mad and left the apartment. in bipolar 1, the mania is quite severe and much more debilitating. Whereas in bipolar 2, the mania could be more energetic, right? They may just feel a lot of energy and a lot of productivity. And it may not get to extremes where it really can lead them to extreme impulsive type behaviors that can have serious consequences.
All right. Turning to Sam, often addiction can enter the picture. Why is someone struggling with bipolar disorder likely to struggle with addiction?
Yeah, so I think like one of the things, like even going back to the family, right? The person that is struggling with this and, doesn't themselves understand it, they do quite often understand and see the damage it causes around them. And having that be something that feels so far out of your control is that feeling of powerlessness, right? Especially when it's something that feels like it's just over yourself, is a lot, right? And along with that can come a lot of shame, guilt, fear, anger, and for substance use, I know for me, it became like that easy button, right? And when I was struggling, when I took this or drank this or used this, like all those things seemed to go away. So that self-medication is a real thing. And for something that I've seen with different community members is They might be using a substance that appears to relieve some of the symptoms of it. So they are quite literally self-medicating to try to relieve some of these symptoms. And sometimes they don't see it and it actually makes them worse. But from their, from where their standpoint is, it feels like it's relieving the symptoms. So, quite often it's that self-medication and just trying to ease these symptoms, and it becomes a solution, right? Not a good one, but in the time, it's a solution.
Yeah, and on the show, we have talked about peer support. Mm-hmm. Matter of fact, we had a recent episode of Line One all about peer support. But would you describe the peer specialist role in helping people recover from mental illness?
Yeah. So I kind of described it a little bit earlier, but a peer support is somebody that has lived experience in recovery, right? And it can look like many different things. It looks like recovery from substance use, mental health conditions, justice involvement, or a number of traumas. Anything that you have had to walk through, found recovery and some solution to it, and you can in turn use that experience to help others that have faced similar, right? The other way that somebody can be identified as peer support is it could be the loved one, family member, or somebody close to that kind of lived through it vicariously, right? They were that person's support. They walked with them on their pathway to recovery, whatever that looked like, and they were able to eventually find a way for their own self-healing and their own recovery. Because, you know, anytime you take a family member, a loved one, it changes the dynamics for everyone around them, right? We're not a sponsor, like an AA sponsor, NA sponsor. Peers are like a guide, right? They are that person that is willing to help you do whatever it takes within, you know, reason and ethics and all that, right? Something I'll say is and I know this gets into another question as well, but the job of a peer is not to do all the work for somebody, right? It is to walk alongside them, help advocate, help them learn how to advocate, and empower the person to be able to help make these changes that they're looking for and improve on whatever the condition is that they're going through.
Wow, thank you, Sam. According to the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual for Mental Disorders, the DSM, as it's referred to, which is the guide that therapists, counselors, psychologists, psychiatrists use to help them diagnose, it provides the criteria. According to the DSM, bipolar symptoms can include a specifier that says with mixed features. Erica, would you explain what a mixed episode looks like and feels like?
Yeah, of course. So when somebody has a diagnosis, with the diagnostic manual, you know, we look with different presentations of the mental illness. And for some people, you know, we've talked about mania, we've talked about depression, and having an experience of the mania, having an experience of the depression. With mixed features, sometimes the person's feeling kind of both, right? They're feeling very down, in despair, very out of sorts, hopeless, but their body feels very agitated, right? They feel very, there's a lot of angst and energy, And so quite disorienting for them, and particularly when they have not been diagnosed, right? Some people may say, I feel like I'm going crazy. Like, what's wrong with me? And, I really want to emphasize something about bipolar disorder is that it is quite a biological brain, quote unquote, disorder. Of course, if it combines with trauma and other things, the outcome is much worse. But these states of the depression and the mania, they may be triggered by an event, but the body is very primed to enter these states. And so for someone, they feel almost like they're exploding inside, and it's not something that a situation caused.
Erica, we have to take a short break, but I would love to finish up your answer to that question. You are listening to Line One, your health connection. After this short break, we will continue our conversation with Dr. Erica Horowitz, co-author of Improbable and Extraordinary, A Transformation of Mental Illness and Addiction, and Sam Garcia, an expert on Alaskan peer support, individuals working with people and families struggling with bipolar disorder. Are listening to Line One, your health connection. After we're coming back from this short break, and we will continue our conversation with Dr. Erica Horowitz, co-author of Improbable and Extraordinary, A Transformation of Mental Illness and Addiction, and Sam Garcia, an expert on Alaskan peer support specialists working with people and families struggling with bipolar disorder. Prior to the break, we'd asked a question of Erica about what does it mean to have mixed episode applied as a specifier to a bipolar disorder diagnosis. Love to have Erica kind of share with us the answer to that.
Yeah, so in bipolar disorder, as we've said, you have the two extremes of depression and mania. And in many cases, the person may be just in the depression or just in the mania, but in mixed states, both of those experiences kind of happen at the same time. The mania is experienced in those cases as feeling extremely agitated, extremely in a lot of upheaval inside, while at the same time feeling very low, very sad, very disconnected from life, very hopeless. And so some people, express it as, they feel like they're going to explode. They feel out of control. And because it is something that is really happening within the brain and the nervous system, people often don't know what to do, particularly if they have not been diagnosed or have been medicated.
Thank you so much. And before I ask the next question, we want to dig into the book, allow Erica to have an opportunity to talk about the book. Before I ask the next question, I want to give our listeners a little more context for Dr. Horowitz's brother, Saul. For years, Saul lived on the absolute edge. He struggled with intense bipolar disorder, meaning his moods shifted really fast, and his addiction made everything much harder. His life felt like a dangerous roller coaster, going from out of control, energetic highs to incredibly dark lows. But by taking a very unusual path, he went from being severely sick to finding healing and inner peace. Erica, would you please share with us why you chose to write this book with your brother?
Right. My brother was undiagnosed still. He was in his 40s. And so he was an amazing little boy. He's 3 years older than me, but I remember him full of life. And he was the older, so he was the director of all our games and just so curious. He always wanted to understand how things were made. He would take things apart to understand how they were. Just full of life. And then when he became an adolescent, gradually we started losing him. He started having nights where he wouldn't sleep all night. He would wake up in a mood. He started disconnecting. wouldn't go out with friends. And the years went by. He got married, had children, would hold jobs and then lose the jobs, had just a lot going on. And it got so difficult. His bipolar disorder got so intense. And so even his personality was different. People with bipolar disorder, often when they're in mania, they speak nonstop, and sometimes they say things that are inappropriate. And so it was just very hard to even relate to him. Fast forward a few years, he moved from Guadalajara, where he, where he lived for many years of his adult life, to the south of Mexico, to a city called Campeche. And one of my daughters, who was then an adult, married someone from Campeche and moved there. So I started going to visit her, several times a year. And I would, of course, get together with my brother. And I honestly could not believe the transformation. Like, as a psychologist who's worked, for over 30 years, has seen a range of patients. I was a director of a counseling service and supervised hundreds of cases. I had never seen something like this, because he did not take medication. I want to just say, I'm not saying that medication is bad. I think medication is great and can be very helpful for people with bipolar disorder. In his case, he tried it. He didn't like how it felt. He didn't take medication. But he was able to have a conversation. He was full of wisdom. And I could see over many visits, he was walking the walk. He was truly at peace with his life. He had healed all his trauma. Anyway, so I said, we got to write this book, because the story is so inspiring. And I, it's been many years since we had the conversation about writing the book, and I keep visiting and spending time with him. And it is remarkable how self-aware he is. And now he can contain the mania and the depression. That's the miraculous aspect about it, because mania and depression are so automatic for people. But he learned to be such a good observer of what would push the mania further, or what would push the depression further, that he now knows when he starts feeling that, he knows what to do and how to talk to himself, and he's able to prevent those extremes.
Wow. Just the book doesn't shy away from family dynamics and trauma. How important is addressing underlying trauma when treating a diagnosis of bipolar?
I think it's very important. I think that anybody that is born with a predisposition to, whether it's anxiety or depression or bipolar disorder and so on, they don't live in a vacuum, right? And so when they have traumatic experiences, they, whatever their disorder is, can get aggravated. And my brother speaks a lot about his trauma in the book. And I mean, he had some, we did have a bit of a rough childhood there for a while. And he had some personal, very traumatic experiences, which affected the way he saw himself, right? His self-worth was very low. It affected his faith in himself. It affected his confidence in the world. It affected his personality. So the bipolar disorder was very tangled up with that trauma. And so he, when you read the book, you see the different things that he did to heal that trauma along the way of really learning to understand his condition and how to manage it.
Sam, we know that trauma and mental health are so often intertwined. How can a history of trauma show up in the stories of the Alaskans that you support? And maybe how does that change the way you approach working with them?
Sorry about that. So when we, especially when I look at substance use, quite often a lot of these things, like the root cause is trauma, right? So, when I talk about substance use, alcohol use, any of it, it's that like I mentioned earlier, is something that became the solution to a problem, right? So when we look at wanting to really recover, we're not just talking about what it takes to stop that drink or drug, right? I mean, I've met plenty of people that are sober or stopped using, but they're still miserable, right? When I'm talking about recovery, I'm talking about that real recovery and like overall wellness and feeling good about who you are and the life you have, right? So it, I would say that trauma shows up in a bunch of different ways. I work a lot with the shelters, so I see a lot of it. A lot of people that are in that state of fight or flight and survival mode all the time. A lot of hypervigilance, distrust. Some people, it's like not making eye contact. You can sometimes hear it in people's voices, and then, you know, definitely in with the substance and alcohol use. So my approach in the community is mainly to keep that trauma informed, or I'd say trauma responsive kind of focus to whoever I'm working with. You never know what somebody's experienced, right? So I go in with that in mind and trying to use the person's, I feed off whatever the person's communication style is, right? So if they are not facing directly towards me or looking to the side where they're speaking to me, I'm going to do the same, right? Because for one, it could be a trauma response, or it could be part of their culture. Like, right? There's some cultures that to make eye contact, that's considered, you know, considered rude. So like, I'm going to mirror whatever that they are doing. The other thing is, you know, I'm generally going to kinda, I'm going to approach and try to keep a, like some open body language. And for me, what that means is like, I'm keeping my shoulders down. I'm not looking tense. I'm keeping a nice, calm, cool vocal tone. My goal is to be as approachable and supportive as I can. I want to be somebody this person can trust, because if they don't trust me, they're never going to trust me to help them. Right. They have countless people that say that they're going to help them get to a resource, or, that they'll be there and they're not, right? And sometimes, sometimes rightfully so, right? Like, but after a certain point, people can kind of get used to living in that background and in that stigma. And it's my job to show them that I'm a safe person. And, you know, if they want to do something to work towards some solution, I'm here for it.
All right. Thank you. We're going to turn to a caller. We have Stu calling, and he has a question about mania, and he also has a story he'd like to share. Stu, are you there?
Yes. Thank you for taking my call. I would like to say I had a friend, I met a new friend, this was like 5 years ago, or maybe eight, I don't know. And she, on day one, told me she's manic. Does that mean that she has this condition that we're talking about today, bipolar?
Erica or Sam, would you like to?
Yeah, sure. We're in an era where people are more and more informed about different diagnoses. And when someone says, I am manic, I mean, they can use it in a, you know, sort of cultural sense of, oh, I'm manic, I'm, you know, nonstop busy, or It's very difficult for a person who's a lay person to diagnose themselves. So if you were observing this friend that when they are in that mania state, as they're calling it, they are engaging in behaviors that may be pushing limits, or they may be overworking, or they may be then one day they're not in that state and they're pretty down and pretty low and crying a lot and so on, that would then indicate perhaps that they have this condition. But the best way to know is really to access a mental health professional, a psychologist, a psychiatrist. Sometimes family doctors can diagnose that.
Stu, thank you so much for your question. Did you have an additional comment?
Yeah. I met this person, and we had the same hobbies. We both love Siberian Huskies, and my wife is a different culture than myself, and she agreed she really liked this person too, because this person who said she was manic became our friend quickly, and she was so much fun to be with. She kind of was not held back by much, and she could turn every situation into a fun, pleasant experience, which both my wife and I really enjoyed. And then one day, she showed up at my door, not calling ahead, and her hair was a mess. She was missing her glasses. She had one shoe on. Her sock was half off, and wow. I mean, yeah. I guess I learned what the meaning of manic was.
Yeah. Thank you so much, Stu.
And it was during the time when you, during COVID. And we had ended up letting this person sofa surf, which is highly unusual for my wife's culture. She really liked this person. And sometimes her relatives, the manic person's relatives would come over and take a shower.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much, Stu. We appreciate your phone call. And we're going to head on over and ask Erica and Sam some more questions. Erica, what are some misconceptions about bipolar disorder you hope that your book dispels?
Well, I think along the question we got from Stu is that people, there's so much talk nowadays, which is not a bad thing, right? That we're talking more about mental health. A lot of people are wanting to diagnose themselves, in order to have bipolar disorder, you have to present with depression for a period of time, and then have mania a couple of times before you would receive that diagnosis. So, somebody who sometimes feels kind of down, kind of not great, and then one day, they go and organize a closet, that's not, bipolar disorder is a mental illness that can be quite debilitating to people. The other piece is that bipolar disorder would really affect someone's functioning, their ability to function healthily, particularly if they haven't been given medication or they haven't gotten treatment. One of the with bipolar disorder, most treatment plans include medication, but I want to say that sometimes people just don't feel good on the medication and they don't want to take it, and so I don't know that it is a myth, but it is a possibility that with the right supports and with hard work and therapy, people can improve from their lowest levels in the disorder.
Thank you, Erica. We're going to take a final break. We've been talking with Dr. Erica Horowitz, the co-author of Improbable and Extraordinary, A Transformation of Mental Illness and Addiction. And we've also been speaking with Sam Garcia, owner and operator of Peer of Heart Consulting and the director of peer support and community outreach at eMend Alaska. Welcome back to Line One, your health connection on Alaska Public Media. I'm your host, Dr. Monique Andrews. Joining us today are clinical psychologist Dr. Erica Horwitz and Alaskan peer support specialist and expert Sam Garcia. Before the break, we discussed one story of recovery, but now we're going to focus on the experience and resources available here in Alaska. Sam, living in Alaska brings a unique kind of the last frontier stress. That's dealing with extreme weather, wildlife, rapidly changing amounts of daylight, and then barriers to access to care. How do you see that particular type of stress impacting people with bipolar disorder?
Yeah, so I would say, you know, Alaska, the weather, the climate is also very erratic and can be kind of all over the place, right? For somebody that is also struggling with kind of like those same things, like that very much influences, well, it influences everyone. It influences me. I mean, especially the further north you go, the darker and the colder it gets in the winter and for longer, right? I think, you know, I see it a lot with, you know, part of my work, I work with veterans on active duty, and I do some outreach to the villages, and for, especially for the people that struggle at like getting out and engaged in some sort of outdoor activity, it's just generally harder, mm-hmm. right? So it just adds to that, right? When you don't have some consistency and have trouble feeling safe, it's like mental health goes on the back burner, right? And it kind of aggravates it. You know, it, when you're not getting enough sunlight and you're in the dark, it messes with you, right? Like that's why like a lot of people will have like the sad lights or the mm-hmm. happy lights. You know, my wife has one. It's like a little sun that lights up our room at 6 a.m. And you know, so it's something that I feel like all of us have to keep an eye on. But you know, when you are somebody that might be struggling with houselessness and whether or not substance use is a part of whatever mental health condition, there's still this idea of like, you got to be able to pull yourself up by your bootstraps and just move forward or march forward. And the reality is like, that's not always that feasible. And, you know, a lot of people, if not everyone, has points in their life where they could use some support. Yeah, so I mean, that's what you see in the winter is you see that increased isolation, increased depression, increased substance, alcohol use, and just more people that are falling out of their normal routine. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I hope I answered your question.
Yes, absolutely. Thank you. And Erica, you're joining us from Canada, so you are not a stranger to northern winters. In your line of work, what do you notice when the drastic changes in sunlight and or weather patterns? How do you see that impacting people with bipolar disorder?
You know, I think this is, you know, one important question because it speaks to how someone who may have a mental health condition has many, there are many things that can trigger their condition, right? So, of course, we know in these northern places of the planet that lack of light, you know, lack of UV rays, it does impact the way that the brain functions. And it's very you know, they even people that don't have bipolar disorder can have what they call seasonal affective disorder, right? Which means that when it's darker and they don't get that light, they end up experiencing depression. That's one example of many different things that can trigger somebody with bipolar disorder, right? Like weather, lack of connection. I think Sam was talking about that, right? Like when it gets dark, people end up isolating, or it gets too cold, they don't go out as much. And so that speaks to me, the important piece here, it speaks to the interaction between a mental health disorder and their environment, right? Whether it's weather, whether it's darkness, whether it's lack of connection, whether it's trauma or loss, all those different experiences can impact. And so for my brother, what he learned was to have amazing awareness about his triggers and have tools to navigate and manage that. And honestly, for the years that he's been better, he's maintained that well-being because of that awareness and knowing what affects him. So for people who get affected by the lack of light, like Sam was talking about the lamps, right? That's one therapy. And it is the first half an hour of the day, you have to expose yourself to that lamp to have an impact. But there's many other different things that people with bipolar disorder or any mental health condition can gain awareness about to then have tools to manage it so that it doesn't really impact them that much.
All right, we're going to go to a caller. We have Joe, who has a question about medication, depression, and bipolar. Joe, are you there?
I am here. Thanks, guys. Good show. As brief as I can, my ex-wife developed pretty good depression and ended up on psychiatrist care, and he gave her an SSRI antidepressant medicine, you know, in that category. And that seemed to help for a few months. And then one day she was under a fair amount of different stressors, not sunlight or anything like that, but, you know, in her life. And she had a distinct manic episode for 3 days, and then the fourth day she came out of it. And I had some experience with this stuff, and I recognized it, and she had no idea what happened. The days just disappeared from her world, and I had to tell her what happened, and it was bipolar. I ended up at psychiatrist on lithium and switched away from SSRI, and couple months later, lots more stress, and she had a huge manic episode with psychoses, some hallucinations, paranoia, you know, strange behavior a little bit, you know, really, and then came out of it again, unaware that that had occurred, and she was off that, you know, prior depression medicine. And I'm wondering, you know, she probably wasn't taking her lithium right or something, you know, that sort of story. But what's your guys' experience? What do you think? Have you seen this sort of a thing where treating, I've been told SSRIs can, quote, unmask bipolar disorder, underlying bipolar. Mm-hmm. And what do you guys think?
Go ahead, Erica.
Do you want me to answer that?
Yes, yeah? Absolutely.
yes. You know, the thing with medication is that there's so many different types of medication to treat these disorders. It is, you're correct in saying that sometimes when people get given an SSRI for depression, when the physician or the psychiatrist has not seen the mania, the antidepressant, of course, prevents depression, but can then push the brain into mania. So that is correct. What I can also say is that in psychiatry, up till recently, medication is a trial and error thing, right? So they gave her lithium. I don't know if she wasn't taking it correctly, like you say, or lithium was not the correct medication for her. So I'll just let your audience know, and the caller as well, that there is now, they can test genetically for medications. So I don't know in the US what, there's companies out there. Here in Canada, there's one called Inagene. And you send your saliva and they test it, and they will match the your genetics to the right psychiatric medications that would work best for you. I think this is the wave of the future in psychiatry, that eventually doctors will be able to test the person to then provide the right medication for them. So with your ex-wife, it may be that lithium was not the correct medication. I am not a psychiatrist. I'm just very well studied in that field. And sometimes it's a trial and error to find what will work for the person.
Thank you so much. And thank you, Joe, for your question. Sam, I want to pull us back to Alaska for a moment. In the lower 48, a crisis might mean maybe a 10-minute drive to an ER or some other resource. In vast parts of Alaska, that isn't really an option. So how do you help people create a plan if they live in rural parts of the state?
Yeah, that's a very real challenge for Alaska. And I think it's funny because I do some national work and people just don't understand sometimes that you can't just get to a hospital that easily, or there's not, you know, an abundance of treatment programs, and, you know, that you might have to take two planes to get somewhere in the same state, or you might have to take a boat trip to get to a plane ride to get somewhere, right? Like, these are things that are a challenge to walk through, even if you are out there in the field with somebody. Nonetheless, if you're working in Anchorage and trying to help somebody get from a rural area to Anchorage to get the help they need, right? And then you take into account that that person's traveling, and, you know, they're potentially going through mental health crisis, or they're detoxing on the plane, or they're actively using still, right? Like, these are all things that just add to the challenges. So yes, working with the resources we have is what we got to do, right? So quite often, if it's in a rural area, I'm going to be working with, if they have a clinic, I'll be working with the clinic. I'll be working with the family and the supports around them to help support and, you know, give the family guidance on how to kind of work through some of these things, and just help to take the steps as they come, right? Making the travel arrangements, keeping that consistent contact, and letting them know that you're there, right? And if you're on site in one of the rural areas, actually walking with them to do these things, you know. And one of the biggest examples I can use is when I'm helping somebody get into detox. If I'm out in the community and somebody says they want treatment, but they're gonna need to detox, if I give them the number for SCF detox or Arctic Recovery detox and say, call them, and then I'll come back and we'll work on the rest later, right? 9 out of 10 times, that call's not going to happen, right? And, you know, a lot of that's because, you know, like, people are like, well, I can do this later. It just becomes something that goes on the back burner, right? But if I say, hey, let's call this place together, 9 out of 10 times, that person is going to follow through and they're going to get in. And it just goes to the show, like, actually taking that extra effort and walking with somebody makes that difference.
All right. Thank you. And you used an acronym, SCF. Does that stand for Central Foundation?
Yes,
Just wanted to clarify. Yep. Well, I want to sincerely thank both of our guests for sharing their expertise and the important work that they're doing in their own personal stories and journey. In doing so, they bring hope and practical solutions to navigating bipolar disorder. So I want to say thanks to our guests. If you or someone you love is struggling right now, please know you are not alone. You can call 988 anytime or reach out to the Alaska Care Line at 1-877-266-4357. We have a few resources, including links to Sam's peer support networks and Dr. Horowitz's book on the show post at alaskapublic.org. Thanks to our audio engineer, Crystal Hyde, and our producers, Rachel Cassandra and Emily Mesner. You can find more information on this and previous programs on our website at alaskapublic.org. Let us know your thoughts or suggestions by emailing us at line1@alaskapublic.org. This has been Line One, Your Health Connection, and I'm your host, Dr. Monique Andrews. Thank you.
Line One is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the host and participants and not necessarily those of Alaska Public Media, this station, or its underwriters. Learn more about Line One and listen online at alaskapublic.org. This is Alaska Public Media.